Hello and welcome to the I Hear Design podcast, your source for interior design and architecture news, interviews, and opinions. If this is your first time listening to the podcast, welcome. My name is Robert Yaminen, and I am the host of I Hear Design and the chief content director for INS Magazine. And we are in the middle of a new series on women in design. So if you haven't heard the first episode with Jill Cole of Cole Martinez Curtis & Associates, I urge you to go back and give it a listen. It was a great conversation. In this episode, I sat down with another pioneering female designer, Libby Sims Patrick, founding principal and CEO of Atlanta-based Sims Patrick Studio, for an insightful conversation about how she worked her way up through the industry to establish the firm of her namesake, as well as her firm's narrative approach to the design process and how that has transformed the way they approach hospitality design projects in particular. We also touched on AI as a generative design tool and much more. So sit back and listen in as Libby Sims Patrick shares her story for part two of Women in Design. Hi, Libby. Welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Robert?
I'm good. I'm glad it's Friday when we're recording this episode here. It's been a long, short week coming off of the Labor Day weekend. So,
yes, I was at the beach and I wish I was still there.
Yeah. Well, I'm not far. I'm here in South Florida, so I may have to head there this weekend. But anyway, where are you dialing in from today? It looks like you're in the office, or is that a home office?
I'm in my home office right here in Atlanta, Georgia. It's a beautiful day here.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you being here, and I'm looking forward to hearing more about your story as we continue our series on women in design. And speaking of which, you know, in the first episode that we ran in this series, I had a great conversation with Jill Cole at Cole Martinez and Curtis & Associates, just about the lack of women in positions of leadership at interior design and architecture firms, and sort of where we are as an industry in terms of getting to a greater level of parity and equity. And she made an interesting observation about how on the residential side of the business, there are likely a lot more women in positions of leadership than there are on the commercial side, because, you know, so much of the commercial interior design projects are so closely tied to business decisions that impact the bottom line. And so, in other words, you know, she was saying that when it comes to dealing with profit and loss, it's still kind of a very male-dominated conversation. I was wondering if you could weigh in on that as well. What's been your experience as a female working in the commercial side of the interior design world, primarily in hospitality design?
Well, I think she's right that there is still a disparity. However, I think that there are a lot of women leaders in interior design firms, and I think it's getting greater. Certainly, it's more that way in commercial than it is in the residential. The residential is saturated, I think, with a lot of women. Certainly exceptions to the rule everywhere. But, you know, I think in our office, we have a senior, you know, CFO that is a woman, and we are completely women-led. It really wasn't intended that way. It just turned out that way.
Interesting. Well, I'd love to hear more about that as we kind of get into your story and your journey into the profession of design. So maybe you can touch on that a little bit. But let's kind of start from the beginning. I mean, what drew you into the interior design industry, and where did you get your start?
Well, I grew up in a small town, Decatur, Alabama, and it was right on the Tennessee River. I'm one of four children, and my mom and dad, my mom is a chef, but she was a school teacher, and she encouraged us to be very creative. She kept us busy. You know, she had four of us in 5 years, so we had a lot of finger painting going on, a lot of craft. She wanted us, that we were all very musical. She wanted us to take piano and watercolor class, believe it or not. But I grew up out in nature constantly. And I happened to be a childhood cancer survivor. And so when I was 13, yeah, I spent a lot of time in doctor's offices and hospitals and things. And so I learned to draw to distract myself. And I also, you know, love being out in nature. So I had an uncle that was a very well-known architect in Atlanta. My dad is an orthopedic surgeon, so he was always teaching us how to put things together. And, you know, he's sort of a carpenter of anatomy, if you will. And he really encouraged us to do anything. And he taught us how to, he's very handy. He taught us how to make things and fix things. And I think a lot of times young girls don't get that, but he sort of, we all sort of grew up like a litter. So we learned from each other. And so I think that was part of it. And then, you know, sometime in my junior year of high school, I thought it would be kind of neat if my uncle would allow me to come intern at his office for a few weeks. And so I became the sort of lackey in the office. And I learned the difference between interior architecture and interior design. And I realized that maybe I could combine my art with architecture, and that would be a true interior designer. So I learned that a lot of the folks there had gone to Auburn University, and they were the ones that I saw thriving. And so that's where I went. And once I graduated, I worked for big architecture firms my entire career. So I really did have this sort of male-dominated environment for most of my career until I started Sims Patrick Studio.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's so much there that you said. I just love the carpenter of the anatomy. I think it was great. But, you know, it's interesting. I've heard so many designers say that they got their start really out of a love of art. And a lot of designers consider themselves artists first in a way. So, yeah, that's great. So as you were coming like into the profession, I mean, what challenges did you encounter along the way as a woman in this profession? And how did you overcome those?
Well, you know, that's such a big question. And I was thinking it's clearly because of a lot of the women that came before me and that came before them. I watched a lot of women in the early days, in the late 80s, trying to be more like men to get ahead. And some were actually quite defensive. I worked for a few. And, you know, we were all dressing like men and trying to figure out the whole navigation in the industry of how we could be valuable, how I could be valuable. So, you know, I feel like it went well for me, but I have to look back and realize that I think I grew up with a lot of great men, my dad, my brother, all the guys in my neighborhood. I played sports growing up. I was very athletic, water ski, football, baseball, basketball. And I was actually the point guard on my basketball team in high school. And, you know, I competed against the guys, with the guys. I always wanted to be that girl that got picked for the team in the neighborhood sports, you know, the team, and, you know, how you would stand there and everybody would, the captain would pick one and pick another. And I wanted to be that person. So I sort of pride myself in working hard and being competitive in a way. But also at some point something clicked when I was about 13 or so, and I said, you know, I really should probably stop wearing these cutoff jeans and competing against the boys and beating them all up. And I think I'd like to have a boyfriend. And so, you know, I kind of learned both sides of it. And I always just felt like, you know, you work hard. Guys and men have been in this industry of business much, much longer than women. Mm-hmm. And so it's similar to racism and all kinds of things, because we've been in this business a lot shorter time. We have a lot of other roles. The man has always been the one that's the business guy, and the woman is the mom at home. And but I believe that now, growing up in that industry, that I just learned how to pull the chair out for the guys, and they would pull the chair out for me, and I would open the door, and I just looked at it like I am an equal. But I realized that I had to work really, really hard. And there were times that, you know, I felt certainly that I was not paid equally to the guys. And that, when I discovered that, was upsetting. And I actually talked to the management and about that. And then, of course, as soon as I was an interior designer lead in an architecture firm, I wanted to protect my staff. And so I ran into some inequalities as we were all navigating. But it was also because I was a true interior designer in an architecture firm. I think my background in at Auburn was really good because all of the architects, interior designers, and landscape architects were all in the same classes for the first 2 years. And that was similar to the medical profession in a way. And then at some point you declare, I'm going to go in this direction or that direction. But I felt like by being in structures classes with the guys that were going to be architects and working on projects together and us realizing that we really needed each other and we have different attributes. And I always just tried to be real.
That's so great. I love that response. And I think Jill Cole mentioned the same thing about just being authentic and bringing your best self to the table and working really hard. And so there's a, I think that just kind of resonates. And you've, in many ways, blazed the trail for the designers that are coming up behind you. So yeah, that's wonderful. So I understand your firm is pretty big on storytelling and narrative. And I wanted to kind of shift gears a little bit and just talk about your work at Sims Patrick Studio. So why is storytelling such an important part of the process of designing hospitality environments today specifically?
Well, everybody's got a story to tell, and it might be an old building, it might be a place, it might be a restaurant. But the reason I think it's so important, and we've actually, I know it's a big buzzword now, but we've actually been doing this since my days at Auburn, because there's so much to choose from out there in terms of product and just different approaches to the brands and that kind of thing. So the reason I believe it's so important is because once you develop a narrative, a script for your project, then it gives you a criteria for making decisions that are meaningful and that the entire team can get on board with, including ownership and operations and design and architecture and even engineering. We all can have the same playbook so that it is easier to make decisions. We use it as a filter along the way to run every decision through, so that even when the project might be in a budget crunch, we can keep the narrative the same and change materials, but we're all on the same board that we have developed a story that we can all tell together. And also, I think it makes projects so much more authentic, more meaningful.
Yeah, absolutely. So where's the starting point? Like, how do you go about creating a narrative for a new project? Is there a particular process you follow or things you look for to help shape the storyline?
Research, research, research. I think we start with that. Nobody really told me I was going to be a researcher and a writer, but that's really a lot about what we do. It's verbal communication, written communication, to be able to express your ideas. So we actually start with research. We look at the targeted market. We look at the location. We immerse ourselves in that location physically, so that we can understand the culture, the food, the fashion, the music, the vibe of the area. We look for things in the environment. We look for interesting flora, fauna, color that this place represents. We look at distinguished individuals that might have affected the area. We want to know what the competition looks like in terms of other hotels, what they've done, what their story was, so that we can then put together words that are meaningful. So we actually start with words, honestly, and we talk to our client, we listen to their vision, we want to understand everything that they feel is important. We want to know who this customer is going to be and how we can tell a story from the arrival until the checkout that is something that they talk about. And so we start with words and then we go into imagery. And the imagery, once the words are approved, the imagery then gets put with the words to create an emotion. And that emotion then gets translated into three dimensions. And so we work with the planning and make sure that the flow is just right and that it works and that it makes sense operationally. And then we start to look at elevations and sketches and feeling how the words and the images that we showed and the research that we did make sense three-dimensionally. So we look at the floors, walls, ceilings, and also all the furniture shapes and forms and rhythm and texture and emphasis, so that we have something that from start to finish makes sense. So once you get everybody on board early like that, and you can filter things through this approved criteria, if you will, then you can flesh it out. And even if down the line somebody doesn't love a particular color or a lamp or a location or something, we can make changes to that, but we filter it through the criteria. And most people will say, you know, it's not what I would do maybe, but I like it because it works with the story.
Right. Yeah. I was going to ask you about how you translate the story into physical space, but it sounds like you definitely have that process and can even pivot in the middle of that, which is great. And yeah, I love that this sort of shift that we've seen in recent years from going from those sort of cookie cutter branded hotels to these more, I don't want to say boutique style, but they embrace this localization, right? This sense of place that where I can be in a different city and it feels unique to that place, but it still might be a Marriott property or a Hilton or whatever. So I think it's just really interesting how it seems to be catching on that's the way to go. That's what people want because they want to experience the place where they're visiting, right?
Yes, absolutely. I believe that. I do when I travel.
Yeah, me too. Well, are there some pitfalls that designers should maybe avoid when they're taking this sort of more narrative approach to a project? Like, what have you learned along the way?
Well, I mean, it's probably personal for each person, but I believe that, you know, and our firm sort of works under the premise that we don't want it to be too themey. So we want it to be more abstracted so that it's a discovery. And it feels good. It's an experience. It's interactive. It's something that makes people have a conversation. We want to have a little bit of fun with the project so that people are delighted, they're captivated, and it's very memorable. So I think it's one of these things that we try to edit our story so that it is understood, but maybe it's not just in your face. So I think sometimes people can go too theme-oriented, and certainly it's right for certain projects.
Right.
It's really, for us, it's all about, I don't know why I like it, I just do.
Yeah. We can also talk about this concept of de-branding. How do you go about like respecting a large brand, but then also creating this sense of place and immersive, memorable experiences for guests? Like, how do you balance those?
Yeah, that's a great question. We work with a lot of really amazing brands, and it's really interesting to understand each of the ethos of each of the brands. And it's kind of fun and challenging to try to figure out what you're going to be doing that is different for each brand. But I have sensed that over the years that we're seeing a de-branding of the brands. And to me, what that means is that, you know, they've created these soft brands. You know, you've got Autograph and Curio, and you've got Voco, and, you know, all the different brands that are going in the background. You know, you get to the hotel and it's the Grady, a Tapestry by Hilton, or so on and so on. So they want you to have the rewards points and be able to stay as a Hilton member or a Marriott member or an IHG member, Hyatt member. But they also want you to feel like it's unique and special and one of a kind to that area. So when it's an independent brand, of course, we're sort of tossing all that to the wind and trying to decide what can we do without the limitations of a brand. And so that's exciting too. And it's all good. And it's all, you know, you've got pros and cons to each one. But I just feel like this soft branding is really their attempt to sort of de-brand the brand, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that concept. That's so interesting. Well, as we wind down our conversation here, Libby, Do you have any advice that you think you'd pass on to younger designers who are coming up in the industry? I mean, whether they're women in design or not?
Yeah. Well, gosh, that's a loaded question.
I know.
I love education and I love having interns in our office. And so I'm very passionate about what I do. I obviously have been doing it a long time and I still love it. And I would say to listen carefully, be a sponge. It takes a while to understand everything that an interior architecture or interior designer needs to do to finish a project, to understand the entire breadth of from start to finish. So I think to be a sponge, learn how to write, learn how to research. I would say learn how to do public speaking and express yourself. Because if you can't express yourself verbally and through writing and drawing, then it can't happen, right? So you're not drawing it, you're not thinking it. So learn how to draw. I know we're all on the computer these days.
Yeah.
But I always feel like you've got to understand, you've got to be able to draw. And also I had a professor that told me if you can draw well, people assume you can do everything else well.
Interesting. I like that. That's cool. Although nowadays I'm seeing people using AI and you know, they're writing and they're drawing for them. So I don't know where this is all going to go.
But absolutely.
I was going to say it is another tool, right? I mean, it's just another one in the toolbox for designers and architects, I imagine. So
it is for sure. I mean, we don't use it as much as we will in future, but we are, you know, looking into it and we're using it for fun right now to see what it does. But it's definitely here. It's coming. I think virtual reality is as well, going to be a tool for all of us to use more often. It's amazing what is about to happen technology wise.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to keep up with all of that with my headset.
Yeah, it is. It's so fascinating. And it'll be interesting to see where things go. But last question for you, Libby. Where can our listeners go to learn more about your work at Sims Patrick Studio?
They can go to www.simspatrickstudio.com.
All right. Well, thank you again for being on the podcast, for sharing your story and your insights with Libby. It's been great chatting with you.
Thank you so much, Robert.
Absolutely. All right. Well, for our listeners out there, be sure to join us for the third installment of our Women in Design series, during which I'll be catching up with Abby Sheehan, the Senior Design Director at Premier, which has been a leading firm in the hospitality space as well. Also, would you do us a favor and tell some of your colleagues about the I Hear Design podcast? We want to continue to grow this community of listeners and continue to have important conversations like the one we had today. So thank you for tuning in. And as always, be well, everyone.